From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, our weekly drop-in at the UN headquarters in New York begins with a press conference from the Secretary General's spokesperson, Farhan Haq, followed by Monica Grayley, the spokesperson for the President of the General Assembly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our guests from Magimu University. Welcome to the UN. Earlier this morning, the Secretary General opened the high-level conference on counterterrorism and preventing violent extremism, hosted at the United Nations compound in Nairobi. In his remarks, the Secretary General said that terrorism is spreading and destabilizing entire regions in Africa. But he added that the people of Africa continue to show great courage and resilience in challenging those who seek to spread violence and hatred. The determination of Africans to find solutions to the scourge of terrorism is clear, he said. The Secretary General outlined to the delegates what he hoped the conference would achieve, notably new and strengthened partnerships between Africa and the international community, and between African states themselves, to tackle the threat of violent extremism and terrorism. In order to address and prevent this scourge, he said, entire communities must be mobilized and local solutions must be developed. The Secretary General said it was time for the international community to step up and provide the financial and technical resources to support African-owned and African-led counterterrorism efforts while fully respecting human rights, the rule of law, and gender considerations. Prior to the meeting, the Secretary General met with Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. The two discussed regional issues, climate change, and the strong partnership between Kenya and the United Nations. He also had a bilateral meeting with Musa Faki Mahamat, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, and they held a brief encounter with the media. The Secretary General told journalists that he believes that we need African forces in peace enforcing and counterterrorism operations to be much more supported than in the past. Prior to leaving, he also participated in a dialogue on the role of women in preventing violent extremism. The Secretary General had the opportunity to listen to a number of women civil society representatives working across all five AU regions who shared their experiences and their perspectives on the opportunities and challenges of working on counterterrorism and preventing violent extremism. He underscored to the women around the table his belief that to deal with terrorism and violent extremism, the solution goes through local communities. The Secretary General will be in Mozambique tomorrow. The Secretary General posted a tweet just now in which he welcomed the Russian government's announcement ahead of the Climate Action Summit to submit plans to ratify the Paris Agreement on climate change. The Secretary General wrote, "We can win the race against the climate emergency, but we need all hands on deck." This afternoon, the Security Council is holding a debate about peacekeeping operations with a special focus on strengthening triangular cooperation between the Council, the Secretariat, and troop and police contributing countries. Expected to brief are Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, and the Force Commander of the Peacekeeping Mission in Mali, Lieutenant General Denis Guillen-Spohr. Our peacekeeping colleagues tell us that senior military officials from more than 110 member states and regional organizations will participate in the two-day Chiefs of Defense Conference that began here today at UN headquarters. This is the third such conference, which is held every other year. The theme of this year's conference is generating capabilities to meet high performance requirements in UN peacekeeping. It aims to generate solutions for issues such as performance, training, and expanding the role of women in our operations. The conference builds on the recent ministerial meeting in March, where member states renewed their collective engagement with UN peacekeeping through the Secretary General's Action for Peacekeeping initiative. The UN is deeply concerned about attacks against healthcare in Afghanistan. Between the 6th and 9th of July, three attacks in Ghazni, Maidan, Wardak, and Ghor provinces resulted in the death of five health workers employed by non-governmental organizations, while unconfirmed reports indicate that two patients were also killed. A statement by the humanitarian coordinator is available online. Afghanistan is among the world's deadliest conflicts. So far in 2019, 77 aid workers have been killed, injured, or abducted, compared with 76 in all of 2018. The UN recalls that all parties are obliged under international humanitarian law to protect humanitarian aid workers, health workers, and facilities. Incidents need to be investigated and the perpetrators brought to justice. The UN and humanitarian partners continue to provide assistance to people affected by conflict and natural disasters, including 13 million people with food insecurity. The humanitarian response plan for Afghanistan requests $612 million to assist 4.5 million people in 2019 and is currently only 27% funded. Our humanitarian colleagues are concerned about conditions in Rukban in southeastern Syria along the border with Jordan, where an estimated 25,000 displaced people continue to live in dire conditions with limited or no access to health care, basic food, and other humanitarian assistance. Since March, more than 16,000 people have left Rukban, or nearly 40% of the estimated total population of 41,700. People leaving Rukban receive basic assistance at temporary collective shelters and homes before proceeding to their areas of choice, mostly towards southern and eastern homes. The UN has been granted access to the shelters on three occasions and found conditions there to be adequate during these visits. The UN is currently awaiting approval from the government of Syria on an operational plan submitted last week to assess needs inside Rukban, to assist with transport for people who wish to leave, and to provide humanitarian relief for those who decide to remain. The UN continues to call for safe, sustained, and unimpeded humanitarian access to Rukban, as well as to all those in need throughout Syria. The high-level political forum of ECOSOC conducted two sessions this morning on the challenges faced by small island developing states, on the perspectives of least developed countries and landlocked developing countries. The forum discussed how responding to the vulnerabilities of small island developing states demands an integrative, holistic approach to addressing their interdependent challenges. Meanwhile, least developed countries and landlocked developing countries include some of the world's most vulnerable populations at risk of being left behind. Many of those countries are in conflict or post-conflict situations. The forum discussed how many people in those countries are disempowered by poverty and the lack of access to basic services. This afternoon, the forum will review progress towards Sustainable Development Goal 8, decent work and economic growth. The UN Environment Program and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, have agreed to work together on the promotion and implementation of global learning and observations to benefit the environment, known as GLOBE. The GLOBE program is an international science and education program that provides students and the public worldwide with the opportunity to participate in data collection and scientific processes and contribute meaningfully to our understanding of the Earth's environment. Through this partnership, GLOBE and UN Environment will cooperate on environmental education and training, citizen science, and the collection and distribution of environmental data. You can find more information about this partnership online. And after I'm done, you'll hear from Monica Villela-Grayley. And then tomorrow at 12:30 p.m., there will be a briefing here by the Executive Director of the UN Global Compact, Liz Kingo. She will discuss the Global Compact's annual survey of corporate progress on the Sustainable Development Goals and the 1.5 degrees Celsius business mobilization campaign. And that is it for me. Do you have any questions? Yes, please.
Thanks, Farhan. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Mr. Patterson, was in Damascus yesterday. As you told us, he was there to discuss the Constitutional Committee. Do you have a readout of that meeting?
No, he'll be having a number of meetings, including today, I believe, he is supposed to meet with the Foreign Minister, Walid al-Mualim. He does hope to discuss a number of issues, including the effort to move forward on the Constitutional Committee. We may have some more details once his travel is concluded. Yes.
Farhan, Geir Pedersen had a press conference in Syria, and he said that they are very close. Will we be able to get any very close to agreement? He was quite positive. Will we be able to get any kind of a readout and any details?
Yeah, I've asked his office, in fact, for a readout of his various meetings. I'm awaiting that. Once I have something to share, I'll provide it to you. But as you know, when he was here just a couple of weeks ago, he also expressed his optimism that they were moving ahead. And his hope has been, in his meetings with the parties, that they're getting closer on a number of issues, resolving a number of issues having to do with the Constitutional Committee. I don't have anything further beyond what he's said in Damascus today to give, but if I get some more details, like I said, I'll provide those. Yes, James.
Thanks, Farhan. Does the Secretary General expect the governments of France and the UAE to give a clear explanation as to how their weapons ended up in the hands of Libya's renegade generals' forces?
Well, as you know, the issue of the sanctions on Libya is an issue that's being followed up by the Security Council's own sanctions committee. And we expect all countries to cooperate with providing the sanctions committee with the information they need about any violations of the sanctions regime. So we're hopeful that that will happen.
Is it your understanding that the panel of experts will be looking into this specific incident involving the governments of France and the UAE?
It's clear that there are many issues on which the panel of experts are seized. They certainly try to follow up on any reported violations of the sanctions, and we'll see where they go with that.
But they should definitely cooperate with you, those two governments.
Well, all governments should cooperate with the sanctions committee. But yes, any potential violations or any potential problems with the sanctions regime, it becomes incumbent on the various parties to report back. Yes.
Thank you, Farhan. Is there any update on Mr. Griffiths' meeting with Mr. Pompeo?
Mr. Griffiths is going to meet with the Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo, at, I believe, 1:45 today. So we'll hopefully get more details after that's happened. And with that, yes?
Can I do a couple more? I'll throw two questions at you. The U.S. has said that it's arranging an armada of countries to organize naval patrols of the Strait of Hormuz. Does the UN support this move, and is it something that should in some way go through a UN mechanism? And a second question, on the missile attack in Libya that hit the migrant detention center, what's the latest on that in terms of the UN, its assistance to the people who survived the incident, and whether or not the government in Tripoli is indeed coming good in its promise to close all these facilities?
Well, we're continuing to monitor the situation, including the situation in the facilities, and also the need for accountability in that case. And we'll continue to explore what role the UN can have in those ventures. That procedure is going on right now. Regarding your earlier question, I would just refer you to what we've been saying about the need to de-escalate tensions in the Gulf. You'll have seen the statements that the Secretary General has said about this, and we stand by those. And with that, yes, one more.
Thank you. One more. Farhan, I'm sorry if I missed that statement, but as you know, we are approaching yet another anniversary of Srebrenica. Does Secretary General has anything to say on that? And does the UN is planning anything on that to commemorate that day?
I'll have to check up about commemorative events. But regarding our sentiments, as you know, the Secretary General's heart goes out to the families of the victims of Srebrenica. We've made clear the failings of the international community as a whole regarding Srebrenica and our own failings as the United Nations. You'll have seen the reports, including from the 1990s, including those by Lakhdar Brahimi, that pointed to the sort of problems that the UN has had in places like Bosnia and Herzegovina. And as you know, through our work of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, we tried to get accountability for the crimes that were committed there. Monica, come on up.
Do you plan anything for tomorrow? Or?
I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much. And welcome back, Bethel, and goodbye, I understand. Maybe not. Okay. I'll leave that with you. Feel free. But I have to say dobre utra to six students from Moscow. They come from the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, and actually they taught me the name, and of course I can't pronounce the name, so I will have to rehearse again when we finish this briefing. Welcome. Well, today the President of the General Assembly chaired this morning a plenary meeting on the appointment of four half-time judges to the United Nations Disputes Tribunal. The candidates were from Barbados, Brazil, Germany, Netherlands, Malawi, Trinidad and Tobago, and Uganda. Member states elected 4 part-time judges: Margaret Tibulia from Uganda, Rachel Sikowezi from Malawi, Eleanor Donaldson-Hunwell from Trinidad and Tobago, and Frances Bell from Barbados. They have all been elected for a mandate of 7 years, and more information on our website. And this afternoon, member states will meet at the 2019 annual Global Multi-Stakeholder SIDS Partnerships Dialogue. The event will start at 3 p.m., so the ones who are interested in covering it, it's in conference room number 1. Under the theme, Fostering Effective Partnerships for Addressing Gaps and Priority Areas of the Samoa Pathway. The annual Global Multi-Stakeholder Dialogue is a key element of the SIDS Partnerships Framework, which was established by the GA to monitor progress of partnerships for the sustainable development of small island developing states. This year, member states and other participants will have also the opportunity to discuss how to foster existing and future partnership agreements. The meeting also will serve to inform the upcoming General Assembly high-level review of the Samoa Pathway, which will take place here in New York on 27th September. And finally, the PGA started her day by chairing the plenary meeting at the J Hall on the elections of the UN Dispute Tribunal judges. She later met with the ambassadors of Jordan, Her Excellency Sima Sami Bahus, and Slovakia, His Excellency Michal Milinar. Both are co-facilitators in the ad hoc working group on the revitalization of the work of the GA. Later today, the PGA will meet students of Montclair University in New Jersey, but they'll be here at the UN. And this afternoon, she will hold a bilateral meeting with the High Representative for the Least Developed Countries, Landlocked Developed Countries, and the Small Island Developing States, Ms. Fekta Maloa Witokamanu. And this is all from us. Do you have any questions? Errol, how are you?
Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Monica, a question. Mm-hmm. As you know BBC very well, I assume. So BBC came with a report today with a press conference from London with a special representative, special envoy on extrajudicial killing, Mrs. Agnes Callamard, saying that waiting, silence is not the option. Directing criticism, though, to the United States, but also before called the United Nations to break that circle of silence somehow and waiting. So what is the position of the, or let me put like this way, whether the President of General Assembly also thinks that silence is not an option on the Khashoggi case?
The President hasn't been silenced, or silent, actually. She hasn't silenced on this matter, and she was actually one of the first people in this House to speak about it. She has defended, she has said from the very beginning that an investigation must take place. And she hasn't changed her opinion. So it is a matter that needs to be investigated. She read, of course, what Ms. Callamard wrote. The PGA has also defended very consistently the importance of journalists not being harassed. We're not talking, not even talking about killing, which there is a, as you know very well, all of you, you know, a resolution from the General Assembly talking about killing of journalists and the matter of impunity. But we are talking, I mean, the PGA has been consistent in saying that journalists should not be harassed, should not be impeded from doing their job, because they tell the stories that, you know, sometimes or many times, many people don't like, but must be told. And she has been very clear on this. You will remember, Errol, that during the World Press Freedom Day, she made a very compelling speech, and she said, if there is any problem about a story that is written and you don't like it, let's talk about it and fix it, but not shoot the messenger.
Just short follow-up.
Sure.
So talking to the President of General Assembly yourself, mm-hmm. when you exchanged the views and briefed on many issues, if you can share, no, it's difficult, but if you can share with us, what is her personal or her thoughts on whether the UN is handling properly the case of Jamal Khashoggi?
Look, it's not up to the PGA.
It's actually
straightforward. This is a matter, as we know, which has been explained here before by very eloquently by my colleagues, Stefan Dujarric and also Farhan Haq, spokespeople for the Secretary General. The entire procedure on an investigation taking place, member states who have to request it. We understood the process. So it's not up to the PGA to say if the UN is handling this properly or not. I think we had a report by Ms. Calamard. We now have the findings. And it's up now to the competent, I would say, actors to make a decision. Yeah, but the PGA from the very beginning, I still remember, because if you probably don't remember, but it was actually the second day of my starting briefing you here when that happened. And for 2 weeks, we were here wondering what happened. And now we know. And the PGA from the very beginning was very clear. And she remains by what she said. So, anything else? I see some of you. Welcome back, Lenta, Elena from Lusa, and everybody. So thank you very much for staying. And I see you tomorrow. Thank you.
A federal judge told the Justice Department that it has to stop making claims that the Kremlin was behind interference in the U.S. presidential election in 2016. RT's Eunan O'Neill discussed the case with RT's Murad Gazdiev.
A U.S. federal judge has told the Justice Department it must stop alleging that a Russian firm accused of election interference was funded by the Kremlin or face a range of potential sanctions. The rebuttal comes in response to unsubstantiated claims from the Attorney General William Barr. Well, our senior correspondent, Murad Gazdiev, joins me in the studio now to talk us through what we know about this story. Tell us about the ruling, the revelations as well here, Murad.
Well, this is a very serious ruling. It not only undermines, it challenges a major part of the Mueller report, because here's a little background. Mueller wrote in his report, they established that the Russian interference, as they called it, in the U.S. election consisted of two elements. The first element, active measures, as they called them, was carried out by the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, a Russian social media company. And they accused them of spreading disinformation, of spreading fake news, supporting Trump and denigrating Hillary Clinton. The second part of the operation was Russian intelligence agents, GRU agents, hacking the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, stealing their emails and releasing those embarrassing emails. So, two-part operation. Now, the Internet Research Agency sued the U.S. government for saying that they were part of the Russian government, that they were acting on behalf of the Russian government. And a judge in the United States has ruled that, you know, he's ruled in their favor. He has said that there is no evidence to support that they were funded or directed by the Russian government. So when Mueller wrote that the Russian state carried out these operations, he was in the wrong. He was incorrect. And the judge, and I quote, "It is significant and prejudicial that the government itself drew a link between the defendants and the Russian government." So there's no tie. This is a private entity, the Internet Research Agency. So in effect, Mueller's argument that this was a sweeping, systematic operation, interference operation by the Russian government, appears to be crumbling. This doesn't prove that it's false, but the judge merely ruled that there's no evidence to support that it is true. So they've certainly won a victory on that front. Furthermore, the government is in violation of certain rules by authorizing the release of public statements that linked the defendant and the Russian government. This, as I say, a major blow to the Mueller report, which is, you know, there are plenty of holes in it now that there's been some time has passed. People have had a chance to study it. For example, they still have no confidence or no real knowledge in how the emails that they accuse the Russian intelligence agents of stealing, democratic emails, how they ended up in the hands of WikiLeaks. And furthermore, they write that the alleged theft appeared to have stolen those emails. They have no confidence that the Russian agents in the second part of this sweeping operation, quote-unquote, were conducted by Russian agents. As I say, a lot of holes, and this is gonna cause even more questions.
Meanwhile, two Russian news agencies, RT and Sputnik, have been barred from a symposium in the UK on, get this, freedom of the press. RT's Polly Boyko has more.
60 ministers, thousands of reporters, and thousands of esteemed members of civil society and academics are all due to attend this inaugural conference on media freedoms around the world. It's hosted by the UK and the Canadian governments here in London. One of the special guests is a certain Amal Clooney, the international human rights lawyer, also the wife to the Hollywood actor George Clooney. She's been appointed Britain's special envoy on media freedoms here at this event, the gates to which are just behind me. But guess who isn't going to be inside? That's right, it's me. Here I am, Billy No Mates, outside, left out in the cold, because myself and my RT colleagues and also colleagues at Sputnik, which is the other Russian news organization that broadcasts in English, we've all been banned from attending the global conference on media freedoms. We applied in good time for press accreditation, like all the other media outlets, and we received a pretty standard stock reply. It said, unfortunately, we have been unable to approve your application to accredit as media. I think that should have been a warning sign, but we thought maybe they'd run out of space. There was nothing specifically about us in that reply. But behind our backs, other news channels got a very different message.
We have not accredited RT or Sputnik because of their active role in spreading disinformation. While it's not possible to accommodate all requests for accreditation, journalists from across the world's media are attending the conference, including from Russia.
The Russian government isn't impressed with this lack of hospitality, to say the least. The Russian embassy here in London has written to the Foreign Office to express its expressed resolute disagreement with what has taken place. And Russia's foreign ministry spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, also weighed in. Take a listen.
The organizers demonstrated their true intentions and attitude to media freedom by turning the event into the means of achieving opportunistic political ends. We believe other countries and responsible journalists will draw their appropriate conclusions, and we hope that human rights NGOs and relevant international agencies will not shy away from stating their position.
And the RT news organization itself has released a statement. Take a listen.
It takes a particular brand of hypocrisy to advocate for freedom of press while banning inconvenient voices and slandering alternative media. Sadly, the world has learned to expect just that from the UK Foreign Office.
I'm not the only journalist that can't attend the global conference on media freedoms. I don't want to compare myself to Julian Assange, but the editor of WikiLeaks is currently incarcerated in a prison here near London. And there is a small demonstration here calling for his release, chanting freedom to Julian Assange. Now, Julian Assange's mother found out about RT not being allowed to attend, and she's tweeted her response. Take a listen to why she thinks we haven't been allowed.
Maybe RT was too zealous in practicing media freedom by reporting the facts of the political persecution of my son, journalist Julian Assange. Naughty, naughty. Don't you realize you are supposed to get US government clearance first? Then and only then are you free to publish.
Now, one more important thing to note here, which I think is quite curious, is that other Russian state-funded news outlets which broadcast in Russia, so some colleagues of mine here in London, have been allowed, they have been accredited, and they have been inside attending the conference. As for me, I'm out here. I've got my eyes on a pizza restaurant.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.